My name is Tepka Hall, and what are you listening to the Dirtbag Batteries? A production of Duct Tape Then Beer.
Duct Tape Then Beer. A production of Duct Tape Then Beer.
A production of Duct Tape and Beer.
Good job, kid.
This is The Shorts, and you're listening to The Dirtbag Diaries, a Duct Tape and Beer production, with additional support from New Belgium Brewing, Kuat Rex, and Patagonia.
My first few days in Moab's Red Rock Desert were kind of like a blind date where everything went wrong. For one, it was August. My metal aviator sunglasses got so hot in the sun that I couldn't smile or they'd burn my cheeks. Trying to sleep at our campsite was like trying to get comfortable on a griddle. Lying on my thermarest, I kept flipping myself back and forth like a pancake when either my stomach or my back began to feel too cooked from the heat that radiated up from the packed dirt. I was 26, and I'd been dreaming of visiting Moab since the first time I'd ever heard of it, back in college at Colorado State. Of course, I'd seen photos in Outside Magazine. I traced the route on MapQuest from my dorm room in Fort Collins to Moab and tried to get my friends psyched on a road trip. But they weren't too into it at the time, and I wasn't brave enough to just fill up my gas tank and drive over the Rockies to discover it for myself. 4 years out of college, I had finally turned off I-70, heading toward Moab. I didn't know quite what to expect, except I knew it would be beautiful. When the highway tucked down along the river and the canyon walls rose up on each side, my heart started fluttering. I pulled the car over to snap some photos of the brick-red spires that poked up in the distance and felt a little bit shy, standing there on the side of the road like a tourist. But I was smitten already. Moab was the second stop that my then-boyfriend and I planned on the way to visit my sister in L.A. I knew it would be hot in August, but I couldn't just cruise right past the exit for Moab and not take the opportunity. So we camped along the Colorado River and hiked out to Delicate Arch. The heat felt like an oven. That night, I lay awake staring up at the sandstone cliffs above our campsite. Even in the heat, I just wanted to be near those rocks, to watch the light changing on them, to feel the presence of the river as it swayed its way down the canyon. My boyfriend kept urging that we go into town so that we could find a bar stool to sit on and a beer to drink instead of hanging out at our campsite. A pit of disappointment weighed in my stomach. That's not why I came here. The moment was pretty telling. Despite the comedy of errors, I was beginning to feel a pretty strong attachment to this new place, while things with my boyfriend were feeling less and less satisfying. My 30th birthday found me single and excited. I was learning to mountain bike again, having put it aside since college. So when my new mountain bike buddies invited me on their annual fall trip to Moab, of course I jumped at the chance. I sat in the back seat, blindly riding along to the campsite where we arrived long after dark on Friday night. Unzipping my tent that next morning to see the walls of Cane Creek Canyon as they glowed in the morning sun, I knew that something was right in my life. That botched first date was getting a second chance. That weekend, I probably hiked and pushed my bike at least a quarter of the miles that I covered. But I didn't care. My hands became pincushions for cactus spines, and my inner knees darkened to shades of black and blue as we rode Amasa Back and Porcupine Rim. Still, it felt pretty good. Driving out on Sunday, stinky, covered in sand, and exhausted, I'd finally gotten to know Moab a little bit more. And I liked it. A lot. A few months after that trip, I met a guy who seemed to be equally smitten. He too had discovered the desert as an adult and had fallen in love. while I'd been struggling through a codependent relationship with an alcoholic, finally breaking free to discover myself again, he'd also been turning to the outdoors to find himself throughout and then after his divorce. We got close slowly at first, then quickly. We moved into a van together, driving through and then sometimes staying in the places that we'd both dreamed about. Slowly and sweetly, the scenic overlooks and the little tucked away bivy spots that we shared began to dot our atlas, like stars becoming visible, one at a time in the twilight. The desert began to feel like a trusted go-to buddy. Maybe even a little bit like a home.
Had been completed.
After dropping Brendan off for a month-long raft trip in the Grand Canyon on a gray fall day, I returned to spend some time alone for the first time in the canyons along the Colorado River near Moab. Driving along the river, looking up at the towering red walls, I suddenly felt overwhelmed with an emotion. I didn't know where it came from, but it felt like the canyon was welcoming me with open arms. And soon I was wiping tears off my face as I turned the steering wheel back and forth along the canyon's curves. What was it about this place? I rode new trails by myself, stopping to look around or touch the rocks whenever I pleased. I rumbled along BLM roads, leaving a cloud of dust behind, and making memories with my own music. I felt more and more comfortable with my own solitude each day, and a little bit more intimate with the landscape, too. Those wordless, chilly November days were quietly wooing me into a deeper attachment. I slept beneath the same ancient juniper tree each night, feeling protected, like sleeping in a grandmother's arms. I began to think that maybe I understood the words of activist and folk singer Katie Lee when she wrote about Glen Canyon as if it were a sensuous lover. She said, "Is it possible to be attached to or love a place more than one does a human being? When you think about it, places are large parts of our psyche. We go to places we love, like the wildlands, the rivers, deserts, the seas, and the mountains. Go there when we're hurting from the treatment of other humans or the society we live in. We need those sanctuaries, those sacred places. They're medicine for whatever ails us."
The reason I'm mad at me, these fallacies just breed insanity. What's not norm seems more normal. Wishing for a storm, the doubles is a portal.
10 months later, I was rolling westbound on I-70. Hip-hop blared out of my single Subaru speaker as I narrowed my eyes at the car in front of me. Was it a Honda? It had a roof rack and a mountain bike on it. I cautiously pulled into the left lane and, not wanting to be too obvious about it, glanced over to the driver as I passed. "I thought so." I pumped my fist and waved over it to my friend Elizabeth, who was cruising with her window down, her dog Dexter riding shotgun. We were headed to Moab for her October birthday weekend with a group of girlfriends. She and I would be the first to arrive in town and were charged with finding a campsite. We were stoked. But as we started to pass campground after campground with campground full signs, our excitement began to deflate a bit. Rolling into town, a traffic jam backed up all the way from the shops on Moab's Main Street to the highway on the edge of town, with huge trucks and lifted jeeps roaring by every way we looked. We methodically ticked off campground after campground, beginning to feel like there might not be any room in the inn. The stress of simply finding a place to legally spend the night was beginning to weigh on us, and I struggled against feeling indignant. Did I really have to share this thing that I loved with all these people? Splitting up to cover more ground, but coming up empty, I finally texted Elizabeth. Last resort option? We'd passed a privately owned campground on the edge of town that I thought looked a little bit more like a refugee camp than the quaint wilderness campground that I'd imagined. But it was getting dark, and cars were still streaming in from the canyon roads. We obviously weren't the only ones looking for a spot. So we filled out the paperwork and stuffed our cash in the drop box. I sucked in my breath, trying not to be disappointed that this wouldn't be the dreamy night of solitude that I'd imagined. We quickly set up camp, only to realize that none of us had remembered to bring a hatchet or kindling for the fire. Thankfully, the young man that sat alone by the fire next to us must have heard us and came over, kindly offering a starter stick that was soaked in fuel. We soon had a small blaze and started talking about what brought each of us to Moab. He was visiting from Denver by himself for some mountain biking for a couple days. I wondered if he knew about all the hundreds of better campsites around town, and if he knew what the desert was like when it was quiet. Staring into the campfire, I thought back to a few weeks before, when I'd spent 5 days bikepacking through Canyonlands and had barely seen another soul outside of my group. I thought about how vast the desert panorama really is, but how special every tiny slot canyon of it is. How could I rightly get frustrated at all the crowds when, one, I'm one of them, and two, they're all there because they also see something special, some part of the whole that still eludes me but has completely stolen my heart. Not all of us can take a month-long trip or spend extended time in the desert backcountry, but every time a person connects with this special place, I really hope it leaves a mark on them. Because maybe the more people who get to feel an emotional attachment to these rock walls and rivers and buttes and mesas, the more people will feel a stake in preserving them as they are for future generations. And if those visitors experience just a fraction of the desert's medicinal effects, physically or emotionally, maybe the world will be just a little bit better place. My name is Hillary Oliver, and this is my short.
I've been waiting on a train back in my old hometown.
Thank you, Hillary, for sharing your story. May we all find a place that captures our heart the way the desert captures hers. You can find more of Hillary's writing at thegription.com. Music today by Black Pistol Fire, Battery Life, Ketsa, John Barry, Connect, and FT Dub, The King in the Yellow, and Jason Tyler Burton. Jason is a friend of the Diaries who was kind enough to let us use his music on the show. You can find more of his work on his website, jasontylerburton.com. The rest of the tracks come courtesy of Mevio's Music Alley and Free Music Archive. You can find links to the artists on our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. Support for the Diaries comes from you. Thank you to everyone who has pledged their support. If you'd like to make a contribution, you can find the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner of our website. A huge thanks to Patagonia for their continued support. Starting April 1st, you can visit patagonia.com to stream our new film, Force. And that's not an April Fool's joke. Additional support comes from New Belgium Brewing, who encourages you to follow your folly. I just bought a six-pack of their new Slow Ride Session IPA last night. It's delicious. Check it out. Support also comes from Kuad Racks, the little company who believed they could make a better bike rack. This episode of The Diaries was produced by Jen Altschul and Becca Cahal. I'm Fitz Cahal. Thanks for tuning in. Feet above this town.